Chapter 3. The Dhimma Pact. The Three Choices. In 2006, when Pope Benedict gave his now famous Regensburg lecture, he quoted Emperor Manuel II Palaiologos, who spoke of Muhammad's command to spread by the sword the faith he preached. The Pope's comments elicited a sharp reaction from Muslims all over the world. One of the most interesting responses was from Sheikh Abdul Aziz al-Sheikh, Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia, who issued a press release stating that Islam was not spread by violence. He argued that it is wrong to accuse Islam of this because infidels had a third choice. The first option was Islam, the second, the sword, but the third was, as he put it, to surrender and pay tax, and they will be allowed to remain in their land, observing their religion under the protection of Muslims. The Grand Mufti referred his readers to the example of Muhammad. He said, "Those who read the Quran and Sunnah can understand the facts." The three choices the Mufti referred to were 1. Convert to Islam, 2. The sword, kill or be killed, or 3. Surrender to the forces of Islam. The first two choices go back to Muhammad, who said, "I have been ordered by Allah to fight against the people until they testify that none has the right to be worshipped but Allah, and that Muhammad is the messenger of Allah. So if they perform all that, then they save their lives and property from me." However, this was moderated by other statements in which Muhammad gave an additional option, in addition to Islam or the sword, which was to surrender and pay the jizya tribute. "Fight in the name of Allah and in the way of Allah. Fight against those who disbelieve in Allah. Make a holy war. When you meet your enemies who are polytheists, invite them to three courses of action. If they respond to any one of these, you also accept it, and withhold yourself from doing them any harm. Invite them to accept Islam. If they respond to you, accept it from them and desist from fighting against them. If they refuse to accept Islam, demand from them the jizya. If they agree to pay, accept it from them and hold off your hands. If they refuse to pay the tax, seek Allah's help and fight them." In the third choice, what the Grand Mufti called the facts found in the Quran and the Sunnah are explained in accordance with the interpretations of great Islamic commentators and lived out by non-Muslims under Sharia law down through history. Communities which surrendered to Islamic rule are considered by Islamic law to have accepted a Dhimma Pact, which is a covenant of surrender in which the non-Muslim community agrees to pay annual tribute to the Muslims and adopts an attitude of defeated humility. In return, the non-Muslims are allowed to keep the faith which they had before conquest. Non-Muslims who live under these conditions are known as dhimmis. The Dhimma system is a political manifestation of two principles based on the Quran. 1. That Islam should triumph over other religions. Quran 48:28. And 2. That Muslims must be in a position of power to enforce Islam's teaching on what is right and wrong. Quran 3:110. The jizya payment rituals. In Islamic law, Sharia law, the Dhimma Pact treats non-Muslims as people whose lives would have been forfeit if Muslims had not spared them. This goes back to a pre-Islamic idea that if you conquered someone and let them live, they owed you their head. Because of this, the annual jizya head tax paid by adult dhimmi males to the Islamic State is described in authoritative Islamic sources as a redemption paid by dhimmis in return for their blood. Muslim lexicographers defined jizya as the tax that is taken from the free non-Muslim of a Muslim government whereby they ratify the compact, the Dhimma Pact, that ensures them protection as though it were a compensation for their not being slain. Lane's Arabic-English Lexicon. At-Faish, a 19th century Algerian commentator, explained this principle in his commentary of Quran 9:29. It was said, it, jizya, is a satisfaction for their blood. It is said, X has sufficed to compensate for their not being slain. Its purpose is to substitute for the duties, wajib, of killing and of slavery. It is for the benefit of Muslims. Or, as William Eaton explained more than a century earlier in his compendious Survey of the Turkish Empire, published in 1799, the very words of their formulary, given to the Christian subjects on their paying the capitation tax, jizya, import that the sum of money received is taken as compensation for being permitted to wear their heads that year. In the third choice, the powerful symbolism of the annual jizya tax payment ritual is explained. Dhimmi males were required to undergo this ritual all over the Muslim world until modern times. It involved one or two blows on the neck, and in many versions, a form of ritual strangulation, signifying that the Dhimmi is paying for his very life with this tax. The ritual was an enactment of the death, from which the jizya payment won an annual reprieve. The third choice provides dozens of references to this ritual of decapitation, from Morocco to Bukhara, from the 9th to the 20th centuries, taken from both Muslim and non-Muslim sources. The ritual continued in some Muslim countries, such as Yemen and Afghanistan, right up until the exodus of Jews to Israel in the late 1940s and early 1950s. And in recent years, there have been many calls for it to be brought back. In essence, non-Muslims are regarded in classical Islamic law as people who owe their lives to their Muslim conquerors. They are expected to adopt an attitude of gratitude and humble inferiority. Islamic commentators are quite explicit on this issue. Many Sharia regulations were designed to impose inferiority and vulnerability upon non-Muslims. For example, the witness of dhimmis is not accepted in Sharia courts. This made them vulnerable to all kinds of oppression. Dhimmi houses had to be lower than Muslim houses. Dhimmis were not allowed to ride horses or raise their heads above those of Muslims. Dhimmis were allowed no means of self-defense, which made them vulnerable to acts of violence at the hands of Muslims. No public display of religious symbols or rituals were permitted. No criticism of Islam was permitted. Dhimmis had to dress differently. The colored patch was an Islamic invention. There were also many other laws which enforced humiliation and segregation on non-Muslim communities. Such laws were understood as a social and legal expression of being made small, as commanded by the Quran 9:29. The Dhimma system was designed to reduce and demean the non-Muslim communities it dominated. The 18th century Moroccan commentator Ibn Ajiba described its purpose in a passage unearthed, translated, and published for the first time in The Third Choice as a killing of the soul. The Dhimmi is commanded to put his soul, good fortune, and desires to death. Above all, he should kill the love of life, leadership, and honor. The Dhimmi is to invert the longings of his soul. He is to load it down more heavily than it can bear until it completely submits. Thereafter, nothing will be unbearable for him. He will be indifferent to subjugation or might. Poverty and wealth will be the same to him. Praise and insult will be the same. Preventing and yielding will be the same. Lost and found will be the same. Then, when all things are the same, it, the soul, will be submissive and yield willingly what it should give. In Islamic law, a severe penalty applied for non-compliance with the Dhimma Pact. If a Dhimmi omitted to pay the jizya tax or failed to obey the regulations imposed upon Dhimmis, the penalty was that jihad started again. This meant war conditions. The Dhimmi's possessions were to be looted, their women enslaved and raped, and the men killed or converted at the point of the sword. A famous example of a Dhimma Pact, known as the Pact of Umar, includes a clause where the Christians invoke this penalty upon themselves. These are the conditions that we set against ourselves and followers of our religion in return for safety and protection. If we break any of these promises that we set for your benefit against ourselves, then our Dhimma is broken, and you are allowed to do with us what you are allowed of people of defiance and rebellion. The same point is made by Ibn Qudama, that in case of non-compliance with the Dhimma Pact, the Dhimmi's life and possessions are forfeit. A protected person who violates his protection agreement, whether by refusing to pay the head tax, jizya, or to submit to the laws of the community, makes his person and his goods licit, halal, freely available to be killed or captured by Muslims. As a ritualized enactment of one's own decapitation, the jizya payment can be considered to be a blood pact or blood oath in which the participant invokes death against themselves by simulating the manner of their execution, should they ever fail to keep the conditions of their pact. Such oaths have been used for centuries in initiation ceremonies by secret societies and occult groups, for they are recognized to have psycho-spiritual power to bind initiates to submission and obedience. The jizya ritual symbolically demands the consent of the Dhimmi who participates in it to forfeit his very head if he violates any of the terms of the Dhimma covenant which has spared his life. It is an act of self-cursing, which says, in effect, "You can rightfully have my head if I break any of the conditions of my covenant." Later, if a Dhimmi violates his covenant, he has already pronounced the death penalty against himself by virtue of undergoing this public ritual, and if he is killed, it would be by his own prior permission. In the third choice, numerous examples are given of when Dhimmi communities have had to endure jihad conditions. As a result of a breach of their Dhimma, whether real or perceived, the history of many Dhimmi communities has been marked by a series of traumatic historical milestones involving massacres, rape, and looting, which have served to keep the non-Muslims in a state of perpetual intimidation and have helped reinforce the psychological and spiritual bondage of the Dhimma over the whole community. Dhimmitude. The term dhimmitude is used to describe the totality of conditions which a Dhimma covenant produces. Like sexism and racism, dhimmitude is not only expressed in legal and social structures, but in a psychology of inferiority and a will to serve, which the dominated community adopts in an attempt at self-preservation. As the great medieval Jewish scholar Maimonides put it, "We have acquiesced, both old and young, to inure ourselves to humiliation." And early in the 20th century, Johann Sevcik described how the intergenerational fears of violence from the ruling Turks and Muslim Albanians produced typical adaptive psychological responses among the Christian populations of the Balkans. They became accustomed to belonging to an inferior, servile class, whose duty it is to make themselves acceptable to the master, to humble themselves before him, and to please him. These people become close-mouthed, secretive, cunning. They lose all confidence in others. They grow used to hypocrisy and meanness because they are necessary in order for them to live and to avoid violent punishments. The direct influence of oppression and violence is manifested in almost all the Christians as feelings of fear and apprehension. In Macedonia, I heard people say, "Even in our dreams, we flee from the Turks and the Albanians." Matching the inferiority of the Dhimmi is the superiority of the Muslim, who was afforded a sense of being generous, having granted the Dhimmi quarter, and refrained from taking his possessions. As one Iranian convert to Christianity put it, Christianity is still viewed as the religion of an inferior class of people. Islam is the religion of masters and rulers. Christianity is the religion of slaves. This worldview of dhimmitude is as pernicious for Muslims as it is humiliating for non-Muslims. Muslims injure themselves when they establish circumstances where they have no possibility of learning to compete on an even footing. Just as economic protectionism can cause the competitive ability of a whole nation to atrophy, so the religious protectionism of the Dhimma can mean that Muslims come to rely upon a false sense of superiority, which ultimately weakens them and damages their ability to gain a true understanding of themselves and the world around them. The system of dhimmitude engenders a set of deeply ingrained attitudes on both sides from generation to generation. Just as racism continues in America and other nations more than a century after race-based slavery was abolished, so the institution of dhimmitude continues to affect, indeed to dominate, relationships between Muslims and others, even when the jizya tax is but a distant memory. The dynamics can even extend to affect interfaith relations involving minority immigrant Muslim communities in societies which have never been subject to the Sharia. The dhimmitude of the West. One of the points made in the third choice is that in a sustained process of ideological subversion, Western nations are increasingly coming under the worldview of dhimmitude. This is manifested, for example, in the long lineup of Western leaders who have praised Islam and declared it to be a religion of peace, whilst at the same time expressing gratitude to Islam. A notable example was President Obama's 2009 Cairo speech, in which he spoke civilization's debt to Islam. Just as the Dhimmi is meant to feel that he owes his life to his conquerors, so the civilization of dhimmitude is supposed to feel indebted to Islam. The worldview of dhimmitude is also manifested in a persistent pattern of denial about the historical and theological realities of the Dhimma as an integral part of Islam and a dominant feature of the history of conquered peoples living under Islam. This denial is crippling academic inquiry and political discourse. The dhimmitude of the West is not a new phenomenon. Much of Europe has suffered from jihad in the not-too-distant past. The coastlines of France, Italy, Spain, Ireland, and England were plagued by jihadi pirates, Barbary corsairs, right up until the early 19th century. Historians have estimated that hundreds of thousands of Europeans were abducted by the corsairs and sold into the slave markets of the Barbary Coast from the 11th to the 19th centuries. Until the French annexed Algeria in 1830, European nations and the United States were paying large tributes, considered a form of jizya in Islamic law, to the Barbary states in order to limit the trade in European slaves. Although fear of jihad terror is, for Europeans, not a new phenomena, undoubtedly the recent rise in jihad terrorist attacks is a significant contributor to the intimidation and encroaching dimitude of the West. Religious persecution and the Dhimma's return. During the 19th and 20th centuries, various European powers forced the Muslim world to downgrade or dismantle the Dhimma system. However, in recent decades, the regulations and worldview of the Dhimma has been returning all across the Muslim world, and with it an increasing climate of prejudice, intimidation, and religious discrimination. When the West turns a blind eye to the plight of Christians in Pakistan, Iraq, or Egypt, they are helping to conceal the reality of dhimmitude and its growing influence on world affairs.